You're listening to the North Carolina Reading Service, broadcasting from Raleigh, North Carolina, serving the blind and print-impaired community since 1983. This is Nancy Jones. For the next hour, I will be reading to you from the February 2022 issue of Vanity Fair magazine. This is Vanity Fair Part B. Here's the continuation of The House That Porn Built by Adam Leith Gulner. Next photo, Helltown. Ferres Antoun built his mansion right along Montreal's so-called Mafia Row, once home to godfathers and dons. And in the photo, firefighters are shown at the scene of the burning house. Antoun, a brawny tech exec with a trim gray beard, is the Syrian-Canadian CEO of Pornhub's parent company, MindGeek, which also runs YouPorn, Digital Playground, and numerous other masturbation-oriented brands. MindGeek racked up an estimated $500 million in net revenue in 2020 through ad sales, affiliate marketing, and premium subscriptions. Its digital marketing network, Traffic Junkie, gets 4.6 billion impressions per day. Pornhub features DIY sex tapes, glossily produced skin flicks, and everything in between. Much of the content intentionally blurs the line between reality and illusion. Is it an amateur video, or made to look amateur? Are those legal adults pretending to be teenage cheerleaders, or not? The real-world ramifications of conflating fake and fantasy aren't MindGeek's biggest concern, though. Most of its executives' troubles stem from the fact that until late 2020, unverified users could upload content, as they can on typical social media sites. Yet Pornhub isn't just any social media site. It's a vertically integrated multi-channel jackstack, endless interconnected web pages showing grids of clickable pornos, searchable by theme, along with links to private cams, and ways to connect with models, escorts, or like-minded partners. Many other websites have also hosted revenge porn and non-consensual material, but unlike most of those outlets, whether on or off the dark web, Pornhub has brand name recognition. The site is free and open to virtually anyone, regardless of age. One might assume that the portal would stringently ensure that its wares involve consenting grown-up actors and amateurs. Moreover, the site peddles an almost unimaginable diversity of freaky sex, including acts involving cross-eyed elves, nose worshippers giving nasolingus, and furry cosplayers. No kink shaming, please. But it isn't all innocuous. Some taglines feature keywords like demolished and annihilate in conjunction with various orifices. Harsher videos involve performative or what can appear to be actual violence. Over the past year, the company began implementing changes to facilitate content removal and to prevent illegal material from making it onto the site. In a widely reported purge, the site also restricted access to millions of unverified videos. MindGeek partnered with 40 nonprofits, including the National Center for Missing and Exploited Children, so that suspect content could be instantly disabled if a trusted designee deemed it unsafe. Additionally, anyone searching for CSAM on the site started receiving deterrence notifications. None of that absolved the owners for prior actions or inactions. In fact, according to a lawsuit that was just settled under terms that are confidential, for a number of years, the company disseminated a series of videos by a U.S. firm that MindGeek apparently verified that depicted criminal assaults and rape. The original purveyor of the videos is now a fugitive. One associate is serving 20 years for conspiracy and sex trafficking. An online petition to shut down super predator site Pornhub and hold the executives behind it accountable has received more than 2.2 million signatures. It's clear, though, that even if Pornhub were to go belly up, revenge porn and CSAM wouldn't simply vanish. After all, compared to Pornhub's 13,229 CSAM infractions in 2020, significantly more child porn makes its way to Facebook, an estimated 20.3 million incidents in 2020, Google 546,704 incidents, and Snapchat 144,095 incidents. Pornhub's origin story is virtually unknown, but it began at Montreal's Concordia University, which also happens to be my alma mater. Without ever crossing paths with the founders, I completed my undergrad degree in 2004, the same year that Antoine's brother-in-law, Stéphane Manos, and his business partner, Oussam Youssef, graduated from the Faculty of Engineering and Computer Science. While still at school, Manos and Youssef created an online porn company called Brazzers, which focused on high production value photos and videos of well-endowed women in, as Antoine later called it, the MILF niche. Since 2004, Brazzers has been the number one name in original adult entertainment, period, explains the site, now operated by MindGeek. Current COO David Tassolo, another Concordia engineering grad, told me that the company's founders got the name from one of their cousins who had such a heavy Middle Eastern accent that when he'd say brothers, it sounded like Brazzers. Manos and Youssef dubbed their holding company Mansef, a portmanteau of their last names. They set up an office with Matt Kieser, a fellow student who specialized in search engine optimization. Kieser, who ran a company called Interhub, reportedly bought the Pornhub.com domain name for $2,750 at a Playboy Mansion party. In 2007, the three cohorts launched Pornhub, a site with an immodest assortment of free, browsable sex clips, some pirated, some from Brazzers. Kieser, Youssef, and Manos have since left the company. Attempts to reach them for comment went unanswered. But back in 2007, the founders shared several core qualities. They were entrepreneurially minded. They were IT hustlers. And they were members of an unlikely real-world community. They played on the competitive foosball circuit. Foosball isn't just a popular barroom game. It's also a sport with leagues and rankings. Kieser was a founder of the Quebec Table Soccer Federation. He and Pornhub's co-founders met during some kind of foosball tournament, Tassolo told me, acknowledging that table soccer is highly, highly part of the story. Soon after its launch, Pornhub expanded to such a degree that it needed some sales management. On to the payroll came Antoine and Tassolo. Traffic skyrocketed, but things also went south. In 2009, U.S. Secret Service agents seized $6.4 million that Mansef had wired to its American bank accounts. Court documents claimed the funds were potentially connected to money laundering. Though Mansef denied the charges, a judge forced it to forfeit $2.2 million. The owners raised further suspicion when local media observed a mysterious private security detail, tinted window SUVs, keeping 24/7 watch over their homes. By 2010, Mansef was sold to a German programmer named Fabian Thielmann for a reported $140 million. Thielmann started buying up competitors such as XTube, Reality Kings, and Webcams.com until 2012, when he was charged with tax evasion. By then, with Keyser, Youssef, and Manos gone, Tassilo and Antoon were running the company. They engineered a management buyout and created MindGeek by joining forces with Bernd Bergmeier, a reclusive, tight-lipped, Kaiser Soze-like flesh magnate believed to hail from the Austrian foothills. Little was publicly known about Bergmeier beyond the fact that he owned a popular porn site called RedTube and lived in London with his wife, a Brazilian model. The ultimate silent partner, Bergmeier, has never spoken out publicly. As the majority owner of MindGeek, Bergmeier stayed in the background, effectively shrouding the company in secrecy. MindGeek became a lot more hidden, Thielmann said in 2017. They just went completely under the radar. Pornhub and MindGeek, though physically based in Montreal, are actually headquartered in the hoary tax haven of Luxembourg, with offices in Cyprus, Romania, London, and L.A. The company's valuation isn't clear, but Antoon has been seen driving red-hot Ferraris and banana-yellow Lambos with vanity plates like Mercio and Yala. Yala in Arabic means let's go, Antoon clarified, indicating getting to work on something quickly, with little patience, which is me. These days, it is Pornhub's detractors who have little patience. The most seismic attack on the company came a year ago in the form of a Nicholas Kristof New York Times op-ed stating that Pornhub was infested with rape videos. It monetizes child rapes, revenge pornography, and children being assaulted. The article featured a young woman named Serena Flights, who'd gone to extraordinary lengths to have footage of herself, recorded when she was 14, taken down from the website. Soon, a merry-go-round of lawsuits started being filed on behalf of underage or non-consenting victims. An Alabama case involved the Trafficking Victims Protection Reauthorization Act. A California complaint sought $1 million each for 40 plaintiffs. A Canadian firm demanded $600 million in damages. One suit characterized MindGeek as a classic criminal enterprise run just like The Sopranos, an assertion the company dismissed in a statement as utterly absurd, completely reckless, and categorically false. When Pornhub released an app last summer directing museum goers to classic nude paintings, legal action was threatened by the Louvre and the Uffizi. As one Montreal source put it, they're in trouble all over the world. Stoking the ire was the ostentation of the CEO's Mafia Row domain. It attracted too much attention, Antoon admitted. I felt a very negative karma about it. It was supposed to bring joy, and I felt it was only bringing negativity, so we decided to sell it. The day after the arson, the anti-porn organization Trafficking Hub tweeted a photo of Antoon's castle next to a portrait of Flights, then living in her car. On top of it all, Canada's government forced Antoon and Tassilo to testify at an ethics committee hearing. Layla Micklewaite, the head of Trafficking Hub, was also invited to give remarks. She told me via email, Ferraz and David wrote a personally signed letter to the parliamentary committee attempting to deplatform and silence me, but their sinister tactics didn't work. That letter echoes sentiments reflected in another letter sent to the committee by members of the Adult Industry Laborers and Artists Association. Please stop platforming extremist religious propaganda that harms sex workers, it requested, calling out Micklewaite, Trafficking Hub, and the National Center on Sexual Exploitation, formerly Morality in Media. Their goal is not to end child sexual assault or to stop non-consensual content uploaders, but only to enforce their religious moral beliefs surrounding pornography. The official hearing at times seemed like a circular firing squad. In front of the panel, Micklewaite focused on Antoon and Tassilo. "What the CEO and the COO do," she declared, "is try to attack and silence advocates who are telling the truth about their site." She said she'd been gaslighted by MindGeek, the same verb some sex workers use to describe her trafficking hub campaign. "The public is so easily gaslighted by these evangelical groups that want to get rid of porn," Cherie DeVille told me. A board member of the Adult Performer Advocacy Committee, DeVille ran for the U.S. presidency in 2020, with Coolio on the ticket, to raise awareness for issues affecting sex workers. In our discussion, she seemed incredulous that Trafficking Hub was being granted legitimacy and that few questioned their stated position as non-religious and non-partisan. Trafficking Hub and Exodus Cry, to put it plainly, are abolitionist endeavors related to a Kansas City church called the International House of Prayer, a point Melissa Gira Grant explored in her 2020 New Republic investigation into the holy war on Pornhub. Grant methodically outlined connections between Micklewaite, Exodus Cry, and IHOP, exposing how the organizations downplayed their larger aims through a covert strategy to reframe conservative ideas of sexual purity. The new crusaders aim to outlaw the commercial sex industry altogether, regardless of how that might affect sex workers, already a marginalized group. The main outcome of credit card bans on Pornhub, which Micklewaite considers an important victory, was that content creators stopped getting paid. The fallout extended to OnlyFans, the booming subscription-based platform that connects users directly with content creators. In August, OnlyFans threatened to remove all sexually explicit content, which would have had a chilling effect on free speech, open expression, and private digital commerce. Under pressure, the company reversed that decision. At that time, a trafficking survivor named Rose Kalimba, whose underage videos had been previously posted on Pornhub, spoke out about her experiences with Trafficking Hub, which she claimed was profiting off victims and treating them as badly as Pornhub did. "She called out Micklewaite as being just one more person who exploited me, saying that Trafficking Hub's approach made her feel violated, exploited, used, then discarded." Micklewaite told me, "I never directed or tried to influence Kalimba's decisions, but rather supported her choices and always responded to her request for assistance." Adult industry leaders I interviewed insisted that campaigns such as Trafficking Hub's aren't simply disingenuous, but dangerous. Faith-based anti-trafficking groups, in their zeal to eradicate pornography, have created a climate where violence against sex workers is encouraged, explained an adult film star and advocate named Ruby. "There are people in this country that would be very happy for it to be a theocracy and to see me swinging from the end of a rope." Antoon saw a direct link between fundamentalist exhortations and the fire at his home. Could the extreme religious groups have incited and encouraged someone to do this? Absolutely, he argued. When you use extremist language and QAnon sentiment toward child trafficking, your words are going to attract and mobilize some of the darkest corners of the internet. "It brings back memories," said my companion, Pietro Poletti, a retired lieutenant detective with the Organized Crime Unit of the Montreal Police Force. "We just turned onto Mafia Row, where Poletti, who spent his career tracking mob-related criminality, used to carry out undercover operations. When I'd contacted him to inquire about how law enforcement might go about investigating the arson case, he agreed to scope out the crime scene with me." Poletti sported a black Adidas tracksuit and spoke in a low, raspy Don Corleone voice. Don Corleone voice. He'd become familiar with this neighborhood, he explained, while following Vito Rizzuto for months. Rizzuto was the godfather of a Sicilian-Canadian syndicate known as the Sixth Family, closely tied to New York's Five Families. In a secret NYPD operation, Poletti arrested Rizzuto in 2004 for his role in the 1981 assassination of three made men for the Bonanno family, a slaying reenacted in the film Donnie Brasco. Behind the wheel of his Jeep Cherokee, Poletti pointed out how Rizzuto's backyard was directly connected to Antoun's. And, as Poletti recounted, it was in that forested area right behind Mafia Row that a hitman aimed a rifle at Rizzuto's 86-year-old father, Niccolo, and assassinated him in his kitchen. We came to the ruins. Lacy motes of ash floated over the debris. No question this was intentional, he said. Whoever did it knew what the hell they were doing. Poletti doubted that Pornhub's foes or Antoun himself arranged the blaze. Instead, he argued, it might well have been a message sent by one or more of Antoun's neighbors. As Poletti spoke, he couldn't help noticing how much bigger Antoun's house was than those around it, how much it encroached on them. He'd built his mansion so close to one particular property that the neighbor could turn the steak over on Antoun's barbecue. Poletti drove around the corner to observe the half-dozen homes on either side of Mafia Row. Antoun's property dwarfed them all. Poletti then stopped in front of the stately Tudor-style manor that had been Vito Rizzuto's before his death in 2013. Next door was the kingpin's sister's former place. Next, the assassinated father's digs. Across the street, a home that had belonged to a capo. Their consigliere had also lived on the block, until he was kidnapped. They never found the body, Poletti muttered. The remains of another neighbor were found. Rizzuto's right-hand man, Giuseppe Big Joe Lopresti, wrapped in plastic, and left near some train tracks. His son, Lorenzo Lopresti, motto, money is everything, was also shot dead. They're all cousins, Poletti said, coming to a magnificent estate at the head of the street, its topiaried courtyard decorated with sculptures of cavorting giraffes, horses, and elephants. That said, the proximity of Antoun's property to those of mafiosi did not prove guilt by association, and neither Poletti nor his contacts had evidence of Pornhub's owners being mob-connected. Tassilo, for his part, told me that the company had never had any dealings or difficulties with underworld elements. I interviewed Tassilo at MindGeek's six-story office building in Montreal, which overlooks an abandoned horse racing track and an orange julep joint. Tassilo, in his mid-40s, emerged wearing a hoodie and jeans with a 5 o'clock shadow. It was noon. His dark hair, slicked back, was just starting to thin out. He had a calm, world-weary demeanor. Almost none of the company's 1,000 or so staff members were in the hushed offices. Everyone was working from home. Many employees are engineers. Others work on editing or moderating content. No video production, he noted, was done in-house. People expect a super erotic vibe, but it's like walking into a bank, Tassilo said. Indeed, the only indication that the complex housed Pornhub was a scrawl on a chalkboard describing a new MindGeek website, Squirted.com. Tassilo had never done an interview with a reporter. Antoun said they'd agreed to cooperate after so many years of silence, because continuing to avoid the press could come off as wanting to be dodgy. Now we're at a place where it's important to be transparent. I think when you don't hear people speak on behalf of the company, it's easy to assume that we're just shadowy porn guys, and that couldn't be further from the truth. Why hadn't they spoken out before? We just always felt the brand and what people saw on the site would speak for itself, Tassilo replied. Gangbangs and throat pie compilations speaking for themselves. Odd as it seems, that's part of what had landed them in this mess. A hands-off management approach had allowed users to post whatever they wanted, which inevitably led to a rise in problematic videos, which spoke for themselves. Now, after the ethics hearings, the Canadian government insists it will create a watchdog position to monitor platforms like Pornhub, and ongoing court cases still seek to determine whether the company's pre-2021 procedures amounted to criminal negligence. Were Pornhub's executives preoccupied by the litigation? As a business owner, obviously it's on your mind, Tassilo said, but as something that is going to destroy the business? No, I'm not worried about that. I'm not going anywhere. We'll keep striving toward that goal of becoming even more of that brand. And how did he define that brand? The new Playboy, he said, a responsible brand working in the adult space. Antoon echoed this view, saying he wanted to create a household name that destigmatized porn, an adult entertainment company that operates with equal parts irreverence and professionalism. Why had it taken so long to take down and guard against illegal material? Tassilo bristled at my phrasing before insisting we felt the need to expedite it based on what was being said, contending that even before the Times piece, MindGeek had spent $10 million on software, human moderators, legal opinions, how to block it, how to stop it. Today, no one can upload without having their verified identification on file. He said the company wanted to work with regulators and with anyone looking to make the industry safer and better. Anyone that has the same goal as us, to eliminate all of this from the internet and outside of the internet, because that's where it all starts, right? Regarding accusations that the company had profited from CSAM, Tassilo and Antoon were adamant that they had always done everything possible to combat it. There's zero value in having it on the site, Tassilo told me. If my goal is to become that household name that represents adult consent, and I allow this stuff to be on, I'm shooting myself in the foot. Saturday Night Live would never feel comfortable making a skit about us. Christoph, who wrote the Times Pornhub takedown, left the paper in October and announced an Oregon gubernatorial run. One nagging detail, though, that many of those interviewed for this story brought up is that in his column, he'd neglected to disclose the extremist beliefs of those trying to silence Pornhub. Grant, in The New Republic, characterized this lack of transparency as journalistic malpractice. Porn activist DeVille, for her part, questioned how it was possible that the Times had quoted a hate group, meaning trafficking hub, without acknowledging its wider views. Christoph declined to comment. Even so, one undeniable outcome of the Christoph article, and Micklewaite's campaign for that matter, is that Pornhub now has improved safeguards, and other sites are also reconsidering long-standing practices. In hindsight, it seems astonishing that an industry dealing with such volatile content hadn't implemented tighter security earlier. While the internet continues its Wild West resistance to law and order, porn keeps getting ever more mainstream. When Facebook and Instagram both went down one day last fall, for instance, Pornhub saw a 10.5% traffic spike. Meanwhile, making porn has become America's side hustle, Ruby told me, describing an expanding movement of makers selling their sexuality online. People figured out that they could just document that part of their lives and earn an extra $2,000 or $3,000 a month and feed their families. Pornhub, OnlyFans, and other digital portals played an integral part in that phenomenon. Toward the end of our meeting, I asked Tassilo what he thought Pornhub's impact has been on the world's erotic life. I honestly think it's been a positive one, he answered. We created a platform that allows any content creator to create whatever matters to them. Through that, people can experiment and see things they might not even know they might be into. I think it's allowed people to be a little more honest about themselves. The porn prohibitionist certainly wouldn't agree, nor would legislators who continue to draft anti-porn laws. The porn industry retaliated several months ago by hiring lobbyists in Washington for the first time ever to advocate on its behalf. It won't be easy to curb content that exploits the underaged, exposes the non-consenting, or disseminates acts of sexual violence. But perhaps porn purveyors are starting to realize that part of the cost of doing business should involve recognizing their social responsibilities. How do sex workers themselves see it? Pornography is a depiction of human sexuality meant to arouse, Ruby told me. It's a mirror of human sexuality. We're a barometer. When humans get more violent, their porn gets more violent. And when humans get more peaceful, porn does the same. It's human nature, and it's a human drive. And it has been since we could paint it on cave walls.
Thank you.
who the F cares about Adam McKay? With Don't Look Up, the wickedly funny director puts his existential dread, plus some laughs, on display. By Joe Hagen. With photographs by Sebastian Kim. Adam McKay has an idea for how a profile of Adam McKay should begin. I would say, suggests the writer and director of Anchorman, Talladega Nights, and The Big Short, Adam McKay believes that personal profiles have destroyed America. McKay is speaking from his cramped home office in Los Angeles, where he wrote the script for Vice, the 2018 Dick Cheney biopic that blamed the former vice president for destroying America. The professional satirist has been hard at work. I kind of like the idea that this is for Vanity Fair, he goes on, because in a way, the Vanity Fair is over. Like, the idea of celebrity. Personal profiles are becoming really ridiculous. Who the F cares about Adam McKay? McKay's publicist might not agree with this take. Since he has a $100 million Netflix movie he's promoting, Don't Look Up, which stars highly bankable celebrities, Leonardo DiCaprio, Jennifer Lawrence, Tyler Perry, Kate Blanchett, Meryl Streep, and Jonah Hill. Then again, undermining the story is a very Adam McKay thing to do. One might even say it's his superpower. Remember when he rolled the ending credits halfway through Vice, a joke on the fairy tale version of Cheney's story? Or when, in The Big Short, Margot Robbie breaks the fourth wall to explain mortgage-banked securities from a bubble bath? And so McKay's critique of the Vanity Fair profile is merely professional instinct. Later, he proposes a one-on-one basketball game to see who gets to write the opener of this story, an idea the writer nixed, given that McKay is 6 feet five and a basketball fanatic. He still sends me several fictional openers, just in case. It's true that we live in an era of cultural deflation, when it's hard for any one person, short of a would-be dictator, to claim the attention of the entire culture, which long ago fractured along internet-drawn lines. In a sense, that's what McKay's latest movie is about. Two astronomers, played by DiCaprio and Lawrence, discover a world-destroying comet headed for Earth. And the political and media reaction to imminent doom is a hopeless farce of culture war squabbling, narcissism, shallowness, and ignorance. In other words, pretty realistic. McKay says it's also the most personal movie he's ever made. It combines a lot of my feelings over the past 10, 20, 30 years, he says. A lot of its humor, a lot of its sadness, a lot of its fear and worry. It's all in there. The script grew out of McKay's alarm over climate change, what he calls the biggest story in 66 million years. It's the biggest story in the history of upright apes. As it happens, McKay has had a spectacular run at making movies for upright apes. He's now the kind of director who gets to cast DiCaprio as a schlubby Midwesterner and Streep as a toxic Donald Trump-like president, as he does in Don't Look Up, and to use what he calls the big kids' toys of Hollywood to articulate his cinematic op-eds. This is a populist movie, he insists. This is a movie meant to be seen by large amounts of people. But success, as we're obliged to say in the personal profiles business, has come at a price. Bouts of depression, a heart attack, a rotating cast of therapists, a tortured relationship with his mother, and a bitter breakup with his former creative partner, Will Ferrell. As it turns out, every movie is the most personal movie McKay's ever made, until it's over, and he moves on to the most personal movie he'd ever made. On one level, it's the nature of his art, locating the pulse of the zeitgeist and making entertainment from it before the zeitgeist moves on. And McKay is nothing if not a topical writer and director. But it begs a question. How does McKay move on from a movie about the end of the world? After I'm buzzed in to Adam McKay's more than 70-acre compound and escorted into his backyard by Daniel, his six-foot-nine bodyguard-slash-piano teacher, I am almost immediately speechless. I had read about McKay's treehouse, but had no idea of just how massive and elaborate it is. A 12-acre network of platforms, rooms, and even a hot tub are connected by rope swings, ladders, and tubes 80 feet off the ground. McKay comes ziplining right at me at an incredible speed from the top of a 100-foot-tall sequoia. "Hey," he says when he lands, grabbing my arm in a gladiator-style arm clasp greeting, "do you want some beet juice?" When McKay greets me at the door of his modest for Hollywood house in the leafy Hancock Park district of Los Angeles, he's still in a t-shirt, gym shorts, and New Balance sneakers after working out with Darren, his trainer. For the next 4 hours, he'll keep a towel draped around his neck as if he just emerged from an NBA locker room. 20 years ago, McKay was diagnosed with an essential tremor, which means his neck and head and sometimes his voice quaver involuntarily, not unlike Katharine Hepburn. I call it my friend Arnold, and you never know when Arnold is going to visit. During interviews, he lies on his back to stabilize his tremor, giving the impression of a guy who's more laid back than his endless list of writing, directing, and producing credits would suggest. The towel is less a Hollywood affectation than a Linus-like security blanket. An avowed Democratic socialist, Bernie Sanders stan, and longtime Twitter warrior, McKay might come off as a caricature of a Hollywood liberal if he wasn't hyper-aware of his own ripeness as comedy material. I'm a 53-year-old white guy, and it happened that I chose a profession that pays probably 100 times more than it should, McKay says. If there's justice in the world, I'd probably be making $140,000 a year. My daughter looks at me like I'm the effing Monopoly guy. McKay is the rare director who's been able to make political films that mostly avoid coming off as self-righteous. An old friend of his from the Second City Theater in Chicago, Kelly Leonard, says he's taken Michael Moore's place in the conversation. Vice was a more or less accurate presentation of recent history, but emotionally heightened and edited into a postmodern fugue of McKay's political anger. His body of work has, underneath it, an analysis of power, a social commentary on inequities, says his friend David Sirota, the Guardian columnist and a former Sanders advisor. Anchorman is one of the funniest movies ever, but there's also deep social commentary in there about the media. The road to McKay's latest movie began a decade ago. Then McKay read a UN report in 2018 outlining the scientific consensus on climate change and freaked out. "I couldn't sleep for 2 nights after I read it," he says. "I had one of those moments where I went from, hey, we gotta effing take care of this, this is crazy, to holy shit, it's happening now. It's not 80 years from now, it's now." McKay first befriended Sirota after reading a story he wrote on NAFTA back in the early 2000s. After Trump was elected, McKay and Sirota began discussing a climate change film that wasn't about climate change so much as the rejection of science and facts embedded in the climate discourse, recalls Sirota. McKay toyed with the idea of a drama, an epic 3-hour movie about these two young people that go on a journey across the country, but decided the better idea was right in front of him, a metaphor Sirota used in his newspaper columns. Climate change was like a comet headed for Earth, and nobody seemed to care. I was like, oh, that's the movie, says McKay. Sirota, consequently, is billed as co-producer. In 2019, McKay flew to Ireland, where he owns a lake home, and turned out the script in a furious way that I never had before, he says. Lawrence, who had wanted to work with McKay, signed on to play astronomy postgrad Kate DiBiaschi, and bids came in from Sony, Universal, and Paramount. But only Netflix, says McKay, agreed to give him the latitude he wanted, especially with the controversial ending. They also dangled enough cash to cast the biggest, most expensive stars in Hollywood. They are what we call liquid, McKay says of Netflix. He sent the script to DiCaprio, a longtime climate change activist who was looking for a movie with environmental undertones. In their first meeting at McKay's house, DiCaprio asked what kind of tone the film would have, and McKay mentioned the 1976 film Network, which might be my all-time favorite movie, Dr. Strangelove, and the 1951 Billy Wilder film Ace in the Hole, which starred Kirk Douglas as a cynical reporter who gins up a media circus. Unlike The Big Short or Vice, which were dramas with implied satire, Steve Carell as Donald Rumsfeld, Don't Look Up is a full frontal skewering, though not the slapstick fare he used to make with Ferrell. Before DiCaprio signed on, he asked McKay if they could include a speech in the script, something akin to the I'm mad as hell scene in Network. And I was like, speeches are tricky, man, McKay recalls telling him, worried about sounding preachy. It's like drum solos. They were awesome in the 70s, but... DiCaprio countered that they could undermine the speech for laughs, and so together they rewrote the speech 15 times. I think it's the biggest laugh in the movie when I test-screened it, McKay says. DiCaprio tells me McKay is one of the great comedic geniuses of our time. For the role of the President of the United States, McKay crafted a composite of every bad trait of recent vintage, including Bill Clinton and a double dose of Trump. McKay flipped the gender and set his sights Netflix coffers high, Oprah, Winfrey, or Streep. I'm like, Meryl Streep's the greatest film actress in history, McKay says. I've seen her be funny. Let's try Meryl. She'll probably say no. And she said yes. And we're like, holy shit. Hill was already a super fan of McKay's work with Ferrell, his favorite is Step Brothers, and signed on to play Streep's son and White House Chief of Staff Jason Orlean, an unmistakable caricature of a coked-up Donald Trump Jr. Adam and I talked a lot about the idea of a bratty kid who grew up with a lot of privilege, getting too much power in government, Hill tells me. Within a month of production, the pandemic hit, and the world went into lockdown, followed by the harrowing presidential election, followed by the January 6th insurrection. The news kept italicizing the message of the movie. I swear to you, I did not want Don't Look Up to be this topical, McKay says. I had to make it a little crazier. That was the big change. I think reality outflanked us. McKay commissioned a podcast about the making of the film called Last Movie Ever Made, which will come out after the film's release on Netflix. Don't Look Up offers plenty of comedic knives for Trumpism. The title is the rallying cry of science deniers, but it's also a brutal send-up of the media. Blanchett's take on a morning show anchor for a show called The Daily Rip is as close to Mika Brzezinski as one could get without being an impersonation. Even the New York Times comes in for a spanking. McKay says any likenesses to actual people and institutions are, as they say, purely coincidental. I do think tremendous shame on the New York Times for hiring that climate change denier, he says, referring to columnist Brett Stevens. But he also believes the Times is too beholden to its own vaunted sobriety, treating the alarming reality of rising carbon dioxide like another story in the Daily Mix, instead of the screaming headline McKay believes it should be. Then again, if you're a top editor at the paper, McKay ventures, Are you really going to go into a meeting and go like, hey guys, I think we should put a headline that says we're effed? Perhaps not. Which is why McKay made an entire movie to say that. We're driving through L.A. in a rented Kia. McKay's long legs folded up in the tiny passenger seat, towel still around his neck, when we spy the Hollywood sign in the distant hills. What, I ask, comes to mind when he sees it? The opening credits of the sixth season of Laverne and Shirley, he says, when the characters move to Los Angeles. Every time I see it, that's all I think of, he says. Me being in second, third grade, seeing it, and then being like, why are they going to L.A.? To try and become movie stars, naturally. That was 1980, when McKay was living in Malvern, Pennsylvania, with his mother, following his parents' divorce. He'd spent his early life in Worcester, Massachusetts, where his bass player father struggled for work while his mother waitressed and went to night school. For a time, they lived on food stamps and got around in a used mail truck. When he was 9, his mother got remarried to a dermatologist and started voting Republican as McKay became obsessed with comedy, Monty Python, Steve Martin, hip-hop, Schoolie D, Public Enemy, and NBA basketball, the Larry Bird-era Celtics. After graduating in 1986, he went to Penn State for a year, disliked the fraternity culture, transferred to Temple University in Philadelphia to study American literature, and took up stand-up comedy. I think my first 6 times on stage I bombed, and then I got one laugh. And I remember what the laugh was, he says. The first RoboCop had just come out, and I said, so this is a movie about a fascistic police officer who doesn't have the emotions of a normal human. So, when does the fictional version of this come out? He was feeling like a failed hack when a friend named Rick Roman came back from Chicago and regaled McKay with stories of the improv scene around Second City and its guru Del Close. McKay immediately dropped out of college, sold his comic book collection, 2 dozen issues of X-Men, bought a used Chrysler New Yorker, glued a lobster claw to the hood, and left town. We called it the Jive Bomber, and we drove to Chicago, he recalls, and I walked into Improv Olympics at Papa Milano's, and Roman did not lie. There were 120 people jammed in there, with this group called Blue Velveeta doing incredible long-form improv that I'd never seen before in my life. I was like, holy shit. His mother was appalled and offered him money and a new car if he went to law school. Oh my God, no, he said. McKay joined an experimental Second City troupe and later co-founded the Upright Citizens Brigade with Matt Besser, Horatio Sanz, and Ian Roberts. Roman, who coined the group's name, drowned in his car during a freak flood in Chicago in 1992. McKay had to identify his body at the morgue. The original idea for UCB, before it became a multi-city institution, was to create scripted pranks in street theater. McKay was reading Artaud, smoking pot, imbibing the avant-garde theater of Richard Maxwell, and listening to any band Steve Albini was in. For one stunt, McKay advertised his own suicide by pasting flyers around Chicago, featuring his grinning actor's photo and the tagline, "No joke." An audience was shepherded outside to see McKay standing on the 5-story building across the street. McKay recalls Close yelling from below, "Do it for real." McKay threw down a crash test dummy wearing the same clothes, and an actor dressed as the Grim Reaper emerged to negotiate his revival, prompting the real McKay to pop out. His material was always super smart and super dumb, says Leonard, who took over the Second City in 1992 and ushered in a new vanguard, including Carell and Amy Poehler. He knew how to make dumb comedy sublime. In 1994, McKay helped produce and performed in a Second City production called Pinata Full of Bees, featuring, among other skits, McKay as Noam Chomsky, teaching a room full of schoolchildren the real history of America. The show was a success, and proved for McKay that American audiences were ready for a weirder brand of comedy than had come before. It turns out some of those people in the suburbs do want the Stranger Stuff, he says. Pinata went on to the Kennedy Center and bombed badly, but not before drawing the attention of Saturday Night Live founder Lorne Michaels, who gave McKay an audition. McKay sold himself not as a performer, but as a writer. "It was the smartest move I ever made," he told Charlie Rose in 2010. During a party in Chicago to celebrate his new gig, McKay met future wife Shira Piven, a theater director and the sister of actor Jeremy Piven. This article will be continued in the next installment. This program is intended for a blind and print-impaired audience. I'm Nancy Jones, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service and broadcasting from its studios in Raleigh, North Carolina. Vanity Fair Part A airs via special subchannel receiver on Saturday and Sunday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Standard Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Vanity Fair Part B airs via special subchannel receiver on Monday and Tuesday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Standard Time, streaming on the World Wide Web at those times. Both Parts A and B are available as a podcast. Opening and closing music by Calexico. Interval selection by Mark Hoffman.